The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. Here we are in late November, in this confusing and difficult year. Snow falling on green trees. And someone explained to me this morning that's why all the branches are broken, because the leaves are holding the heavy snow. And so as I walked down Bleecker Street yesterday, you know, it's just a mass of broken branches all down the street. And at the same time, the brilliant acacias and the red maples, incredible colors. And their messy leaves that are falling everywhere, some of them soggy now after the snow. And I love that. I love that messiness. And then there's the leaf blowers that come. The ones that stalk the parks. Their loud sounds and emissions. Let me digress for a moment from the Dharma and read something from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Emissions from gas-powered leaf blowers are substantial. The amount of CO, carbon monoxide, emitted from a typical backpack leaf blower for just 1 hour is equal to carbon monoxide coming from the tailpipe of a current year automobile operating for over 8 hours. Who knew? For the other pollutants, the amounts are even greater. So my initial intention was to lull you into an appreciation of the fall. The wonderful golden sepia-colored autumn in New York. But I fell into the reality of our lives. Fires in California, floods in Thailand, floods in the Dead Sea, floods in Jordan. All over the world, victims of climate change, of lack of food and water, and the resulting oppressive political regimes that come to power. And the victims, in order to save themselves, in order to find a place to live in peace with food and water, are walking north towards all the countries that have more resources. Countries that have not yet felt the sting of this disastrous climate change. Does this sound like a Dharma talk? Or reality today? And is there a difference between those two? One person who emphasized that there's no difference was my Zen teacher, Bernie Glassman. And as many of you know, Bernie died just 2 weeks ago on November 4th. He was our Village Zendo's honorary abbot and my own transmission teacher. That is a very close relationship. We did have an intimate memorial service last Saturday after the Zazen Kai, and we'll have a more public one in January, in late January. But for now, I just want to encourage us all to appreciate his teachings. His sensitivities were to the suffering people of the world. And he was willing to serve them and the Zen teachings that he had studied for so long. He broke down barriers like a good, true Zen master, including our ideas about what Zen is, what compassion is, what serving is. Now, I remember the first time I met Bernie, sometime around 1987. Bernie and others at the Grayston Seminary, which was his Zen center, had created something called the Grayston Family Inn, and at that time they were renovating a large apartment building that had been, abandoned and covered up for years. And the building was to include housing for homeless people, whom they were hiring for the bakery, which was the financial center of the system. And they were going to have a daycare center, and they did eventually, and a counseling offices for the people who would live there. And at that time, I was studying in a very old-fashioned Zen center, kind of one that kind of emulated one's ideas of what it might have been in some fantastical other world, a Zen center with Dido De Lori at Zen Mountain Monastery. And Dido and Bernie were Dharma brothers, when Bernie asked for some help in documenting his work, Dido, I wrote, ask me, but actually sent me. He never asked anybody anything. Sent me down to videotape the work being done. I was then teaching at NYU in the Media Studies Department, and I used to do a lot of video work for Dido. And so I had heard of this man called Tetsugen at the time. That was his Dharma name. Iron Beginning, Tetsugen. And he was our generation's first patriarch, a new wave of Zen in America, Mayazumi Roshi's first Dharma successor. And so when I arrived at the construction site in Yonkers on Park Avenue, I met Bernie. He looked just like an ordinary guy. There was some aura still of Zen style. He still shaved his head. He was wearing a yellow construction helmet, a very rumpled and dirty brown samurai jacket, blue jeans, and construction boots. And he immediately handed me a helmet, and we began to climb all over this old abandoned building, and I would shoot it from different angles and with different people who were working on it, he recorded his planned renovations and so forth. At that time he was a strong political force in Yonkers because not much was being done in Yonkers for the homeless population, and he became kind of a rock star in what was then be called socially responsible entrepreneurship, where he making businesses and operations that would be socially responsible, hire people who had prison records, and take chances with people and teach them how to work in the bakery. So it was very inspiring to all of us. But as for me, I was still a bit new to Zen practice. And I yearned for a traditional, more kind of intensive meditation practiced, something that emphasized zazen, retreats, chanting. I did not realize at the time what a profound influence he would have on my life. A blessed effect. Bernie and his second wife, Jishu, continued to build this the Greyston Mandala out, and they also added this huge opportunity for housing for people with HIV/AIDS. Note the time, right? Late 80s, early 90s, a place for people to live and to die. Counseling services. All the while maintaining this business of the Greyston Bakery, which held everything together, you know, which is a demanding work too. So it was a fragmented, difficult time, and the Zen community there either was able to make the transition into social action work, or they moved away. So the community itself wasn't able to sustain all the work that was being done. So a couple of years later, I moved on to study with Maizumi Roshi in Los Angeles. And I occasionally met Bernie when he visited. Already now he was on broadcasting, NBC, they did things about him. He was a big, important guy. His renown towered over Maizumi Roshi's, right? Maizumi Roshi appeared to be more or less a simple Zen master. And I have this memory so strong I wanted to share with you. We were sitting in the Zendo in LA. Maizumi Roshi was getting ready to give a talk. And Bernie was sitting right next to him, kind of like Yuka sitting kind of next to me. But smaller space, so closer, kind of like right here. And Maizumi Roshi began to speak. Bernie so gently and so lovingly just kind of reached over and just kind of adjusted the okesa that Maizumi Roshi was wearing. In just the most humble and simple way of showing his love and caring for his master. And he showed all of us in that room, you know, how to love, how to care for Maizumi. It was just a small detail, but I was so struck by it. His caring for his teacher, his humility, actually. And also, oddly enough, you know, Bernie was a stickler for the way things ought to be in the ritual tradition. And if Maizumi Roshi's okesa was slightly off, it had to be fixed. This guy that was breaking all the rules knew the rules very well. That's so lovely. Yeah. In 1995, Maizumi Roshi died. And poor Bernie was so busy with all of these things, he suddenly was tasked as the first Dharma successor to take over the White Plum Asanga, which had over like 125 teachers all over Europe, all over the United States. And he was like the head then. He inherited that. Maizumi Roshi died suddenly. And so this kind of fell on Bernie, who did not want to do that. And abandoned students, including me. Bernie opened his arms to me and said, "You can be my student, come and practice with me." I had no idea what that entailed, because it was learning a lot about social entrepreneurship, learning a lot about working in that world. And oddly enough, as I said before, Bernie knew the rituals and traditions really well, so I was by working for him, which was his way of teaching, I learned so much. It was like an incredible gift that he gave me. He broke down the walls of this cloistered idea of Zen practice. And he did that through the teachings, not against them. Uh, I was always struck by the depth of his insight. I had never met someone who had such a deep insight. So he didn't lecture us, tell us to do something about the suffering in the world. He was doing something about the suffering in the world. His vision increased. He started the Auschwitz retreats. There was such opposition to that when he first talked about it. And people came, and when the first Auschwitz retreat we did, there was a lot of controversy, there was a lot of issues, and people began to really understand what it is to bear witness to suffering, to bear witness to sorrow, to anger, to hatred, to guilt. A lot of people who were children of perpetrators attended those retreats. Very, very heartbreaking to see. The street retreats, how people are treated. They're ordinary people. You know, we used to go down to the Bowery Mission all the time on our street retreats. And then you go and sit down and talk to someone who lives on the street and get a little different view of the world you live in. It was powerful, powerful work. He called it going to the cracks. The dirty little places where things don't fit together so simply as in our lives. Streets in Los Angeles, in the Bowery, homeless shelters, AIDS wards in the 90s. So very conveniently for me, his teaching fits exactly into the koan we are studying this month in the PATH koan class. In case 89 of the Book of Serenity, Hongxi relates a story about Dongshan, the founder of our school of Zen. The story takes place at the end of a long retreat. So, you know, in a long retreat, silence, no interaction, no paying attention to what's going on outside of your own mind, your own breath. So the attention is very focused on what we call it the absolute, that completely absolute state of mind. Like, hopefully, after one period of Zazen here. Huh? But we try, and it does happen. So, this is what the case reads. The name of it is No Grass. And Dongshan said to the assembly, "In the beginning of it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you folks will go, some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He then said, "But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go?" Another teacher, Xisheng, said, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." Yet another teacher, Dayang, said, "I'd say even not going out the gate, still, the grass is boundless." So, it's the beginning of, you know, it's the bell has rung. It's time for us to move into the world, as he says. Some of you are going to go east. Some of you are going to go west. Some of you are going to take the 6. Some of you are going to take the R. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? The other guy says, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." And Dayang says, "Not even going out the gate, still the grass is boundless. So, what is this inside the gate, outside the gate? When we stop thinking, when we stop manufacturing thoughts, our fantasies, our complaints, our memory, our creativity, when instead we simply breathe, oneness, just oneness. What is there then? Who is there then? Isn't it the freedom to start anew? A different sense of who we are. A sense that includes more than this skin bag, but much more. The birds, the air, our zazen sitters that sit around us, and also all those we think are not us, the poor, the guys over at Rikers and the girls over at Rikers, the angry ones on the other side, the suffering, this very earth, all of that in a particular way of being is also us. So we cling to our little sense of self, our teeny sense of self, and we forget this other aspect of ourselves. Bernie experienced this and he taught this. You know, samadhi, etymology, I can't say it, from etymology, means gathered together, where we feel whole and fresh and able to perceive new, different ways. And it's momentary, doesn't last. If we are aware of our samadhi, we can allow it to change us. And this is what Dongshan is looking at, is indicating in this koan. After this long practice period where everybody is sitting in samadhi, or you can imagine after the last half hour ago, when you're sitting in samadhi, there's no grass anywhere. Go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So imagine a patch of lawn, all those individual leaves, each one, little bit spears of grass. In Zen literature, grass usually symbolizes the relative, the specific individuality of things. So you could say all of us, like we're like leaves of grass, spears of grass here. And then you'd say the whole thing, oh, it's a zendo. When you say it's a zendo, or you say it's a lawn, you're looking at it as a wholeness. Huh? Go to a place where there's no grass. When we look out our window, you know, here, you can see the Lower East Side, or you can see the Puck Building, Old St. Pat's, individual buildings, individual histories and people. But the whole thing, we call it the Lower East Side. We call it the absolute. And what is that wholeness? The place of oneness, stillness, no thought, no subject, object, unity. One of Dogen's poems comes to mind. In the heart of the night, the moonlight framing a small boat drifting, tossed not by the waves, nor swayed by the breeze. In the heart of the night, the moonlight framing a small boat drifting, tossed not by the waves, nor swayed by the breeze. Dongshan's place of no grass, or Dogen, as he puts it, is a place we're not disturbed by waves, we're not disturbed by wind and clouds, we are still, at the still point, at our center. Very peaceful, very quiet, very complete, at one. I think it's what many of us seek in our spiritual practice. And maybe you experienced that this morning for a brief second, a few moments. When you go on retreat, sometimes a little more. Maybe for a moment you were able to just kind of let it go. All the habits and delusions and attachments, the half-truths and fantasies, the lies we tell ourselves. Just as we are. Dogen says, not tossed by the waves, not swayed by the breeze of our delusions. Delicious stillness. Some of us are addicted to that. But Dongshan, after telling us to go to that place, says, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? In a place of oneness, there's no movement. There's no way to say, I'm going from point A to point B, because there's no point A and point B. There's just that wholeness. Shishang says, well, going out the gate immediately, there's grass. The bell rings, we get up. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize my back. Oh. And then later, going out the gate immediately, there is grass, is what Bernie taught. The minute we shift our perceptions, our gates, you know, and that's the word gates, going out the gate, in the gate, traditionally in all of the Buddhist sutras, the gates are the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. There are gates of perception. Did I do something wrong with my... Okay. So the minute we shift back into being aware of our gates, then there are all these things that are there. They're everywhere. There are people suffering, people to help, people to serve, people to stop. By introducing this idea of gate, going in, going out, we have a way to live our lives in and out. Being able to shift easily back and forth from our awareness of our oneness to our awareness of our multiplicity. In the state of oneness, we can't help anybody because there's no anybody extra separate from this oneness. But in, when we go out the gate, we're there to serve. And so that's why Zazen is the heart of appropriate social action. It's at the heart of bodhisattva activity. Because there's confusion, the moment we step out. To learn how to practice our zazen, that moment, that stillness in the midst of our activity, is the key of being connected to our own true nature and to live up to our responsibility as a living being, to care for and support other living beings. So Bernie's years of practice wound up sitting on a bench with a homeless person, having a conversation, sharing a sandwich. That's going out the gate. But the other Zen master, Dai Young, says, even not going out the gate, still the grass is boundless. Meaning, don't get a fixed idea of oneness, of samadhi. Don't get a fixed idea of peace. It's just another grass. Another delusion. Something to cling to. Who's clinging to what? Those are two. The whole idea of gate and not gate is illusory. Each moment we're reacting in response to what's the light in the room, the sounds. We're blessed today with no sounds sometimes, not so much here. But everything we do, regardless of our state of our mind, is an interaction with everything else around us. And what does Guangxi say about this, the guy who collected these and writes poems about them? Grass is boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, see it for yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look, how many kinds. For the while going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. Hongxi is telling us not to discriminate between grass and no grass, between gate and no gate, inside or outside, but to take up our life in the weeds where we are, to enter the world of suffering and to offer what we can, whether it's political action, a warm hand, looking into someone's eyes for a moment, an ear that will listen, a heart that will witness. Cultivate this empty field and share ourselves in the marketplace. This practice of Zazen that we've been doing this morning teaches us over and over again that there is no other, no defining characteristic or color of skin or gender preference or sexual preference, no religion or culture that makes another. It's all in our minds. And it is our minds that can change our actions and can change the world. is, in many ways, it may be frightening, but it's an exciting time to be alive. In this conservative country, who would have thought? When all the fixed ideas of gender and race and sexuality and class are just being disrupted. We have to look at what we call justice. We have to look at what we call rehabilitation. Huh? All of it. The dangers of losing sight of the vastness, the interconnected quality of life. It was this teaching that Bernie gave me, how to activate the profundity of the Zen tradition. So my gatha in closing is, thank you, Bernie, for waking us up to what has always been our true nature.